This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, thanks for joining me on ABC Radio National for Rear Vision. I'm Keri Phillips.
Nicole Kidman has begun a tour of Kosovo, her first as a United Nations Goodwill Ambassador to support women's rights. The visit comes at a delicate time, with ethnic Albanians and Serbs engaged in intense negotiations over the territory's future.
I'm here as Goodwill Ambassador to learn so that I can help your country at this crucial, crucial time in its future.
Nicole Kidman, recently in Kosovo, a Balkan province that has been run by the United Nations since 1999. Although Kosovo is technically part of Serbia, the mostly Albanian population would like independence. A decision on Kosovo's future had been promised by the end of this year, but last month Serbia called an election for next month and the UN deferred a proposal on Kosovo's final status. The West fears that announcing any increase in Kosovo's autonomy might encourage voter support for Serbian ultranationalists. Today on Rear Vision, a history of Kosovo and an attempt to understand why this poor part of the world, about one-ninth the size of Tasmania and with a population of about 2 million, is so passionately contested. Kenneth Morrison teaches at the School of Slavonic and East European Studies at University College London.
We can trace the region. I mean, we know the history of the region all the way back to the arrival of the, in fact, before the arrival of the Slavs in the 4th or 5th century. We know, for example, that Kosovo was inhabited by a group called the Illyrians prior to the period of the Slavic migrations into the Balkans. But Kosovo was really settled by Serbs between the 7th and 10th centuries, if you like. And during this period, the Serbs are mainly crop farmers and inhabited only the plains and rivers of present-day Kosovo, leaving the mountainous areas to kind of present-day Balkan shepherds or the Albanians, as we can call them. Of course, it's very difficult to talk in terms of Albanians, Serbs, all of these different ethnic groups or ideas even of a state territory, because these weren't really formed until the fragmentation of the Ottoman Empire in the 19th century. We start to see the emergence of national ideas. It's difficult to say whether in the 13th century, for example, Albanians in Kosovo understood themselves to be Albanians. Almost certainly not. Serbs, of course, many Serb historians will tell you that the Serbs did recognise themselves as a specific entity at that point. I mean, the issue with Kosovo in terms of Serbia's claim to Kosovo is that Kosovo was incorporated into the medieval Serbian Empire, which reached its peak in the period of Stefan Dušan between 1331 and 1355. It became the kind of state, political, economic and cultural centre of the Serbian nation. And during that period, many, many churches, monasteries were built in Kosovo. In fact, more so in Kosovo than any other Serbian land. So during this period in the 14th century, the early to mid-14th century, Kosovo really became the spiritual nucleus of the Serbs. Now, of course, the Albanian claim is prior to that, that land had always been theirs and it was part of us kind of policy on behalf of the Serbian medieval empire to dominate this region and populate it with Serbs.
This came to an end with the Battle of Kosovo in 1389. Dr. Jasna Dragovic-Sozo is a lecturer in international relations at Goldsmiths College at the University of London.
It really was part of sort of the protracted Ottoman conquest of the Balkans in the 14th century. It wasn't necessarily even the most significant battle within that period, but it did pit the invading Ottoman army, which was led by its sultan, Murad, against the army of the medieval Serbian kingdom, which was led by a nobleman called Prince Lazar Hrebljanović. And in fact, there's very little that is known about the history of this battle, other than that both leaders were killed in its course. And the historical chronicles really tend to describe it as more of a draw than as an actual defeat. It actually took the Ottomans more than 70 years after that to conquer Serbia and to spread their rule over the Balkans. So the importance of the battle really lies more in its symbolic value as the turning point that marked the end of the medieval Serbian state and the beginning of what is popularly perceived in Serbia as the Dark Turkish Night.
And that battle, however significant or insignificant you may think it is in broader European terms, became very, very important to the psyche of the Serbs. And throughout their oral history, their oral tradition, and the Serbian Orthodox Church, of course, promoted this idea as well, that Kosovo was the very heart of Serbia, that the monasteries were there. In some sense, Serbia's soul was in Kosovo, and that it should be brought back into the bosom of Serbia one day.
Ottoman rule in Kosovo marked the beginning of a migration north by the Christian Serbs and a movement into the area by Muslim Albanians, a demographic shift that reached a peak in the 18th century when Kosovo became predominantly Albanian. Although many Serbs converted to Islam, the majority managed to keep their culture and religion through the long period of Ottoman rule. Then during the 19th century, Serbian uprisings were inspired by the nationalist ideas sweeping Western Europe.
Like all nationalisms in the 19th century, Serbian nationalism was based to a large degree on existing symbols and myths that had been basically propagated throughout the period of Turkish rule. And the Kosovo myth was a central one, as well as the myth of the great medieval Serbian kingdom. So within this nationalist ideology, the recovery of Kosovo, which was the center of the old medieval Serbian kingdom and was viewed as the Serbs' holy land, well, the recovery of Kosovo was really quite central to all Serbian state-building projects since the early part of the 19th century. And Serbian nationalism then also received a huge boost in the form of the progressive defeat and withdrawal of the Ottomans from the Western Balkans and the creation by 1878 of an independent Serbian kingdom. And in the latter part of the 19th century, the Serbian state played an instrumental role in articulating the goal of liberating the remaining Serbian lands, or what were considered to be the remaining Serbian lands, from foreign rule and unifying them into a single state. So this was really used as a way of inspiring young men to join up and fight against foreign occupation and extend the Serbian lands. And of course, within this framework, Serbian nationalism really aimed at expansion of the existing Serbian state to encompass all the Serbs living in the Balkans and also all the South Slavs. And the differentiation between the two wasn't always very clear. There was also the beginnings of Albanian nationalism taking place in the region, very much again in response to the rise of other nationalisms, particularly the Greek, the Montenegrin and the Serbian, which was very much a reaction to plans to partition territories inhabited by Albanians. And so you get the creation of what was known as the League of Prizren, Prizren being a town in Kosovo, among the Albanians, uniting all the different Albanian lords and also religious authorities in order to work towards the idea of creating an Albanian unit, if you want, within the Ottoman Empire and resisting those claims to what were considered to be Albanian territories by the Christian kingdoms.
Although complete independence had been granted to Serbia by the Great Powers in the Treaty of Berlin in 1878, it wasn't until the Balkan Wars of 1912 and 1913 that Serbia regained Kosovo.
There were two of them. The first one pitted a coalition of the newly created Christian kingdoms of Greece, Montenegro, Serbia, and Bulgaria against the Ottomans, where the Ottomans were essentially defeated. And then this was the 1912 war. The 1913 war basically was a coalition of the Greeks, the Serbs, and the Montenegrins against the Bulgarians over Macedonia, in which the Bulgarians were defeated, and so there was a partition of territory again. During those wars, the Albanians were essentially bystanders, from what I can tell. I mean, they didn't actively fight with the Ottomans, but they didn't really endorse the Christian kingdoms either. And the 1912 war was the one in which the Serbian kingdom essentially reconquered Kosovo. And it did so in a particularly brutal way, in which Albanian civilians were massacred, villages burned, and so on and so forth. And which, of course, started a cycle of violence and counter-violence, which was to characterize relations in the 20th century for Serbs and Albanians in the region.
This redrawing of borders was quickly followed by World War I. Since the Serbs were on the winning side, their long-standing goal of liberation and unification of Serbs and South Slavs into a common state was realized following the war with the creation of the Kingdom of Serbs, Croats and Slovenes, renamed the Kingdom of Yugoslavia in 1929. Kosovo remained part of Yugoslavia until 1941, when, during the Second World War, it became part of Italian-controlled Albania. This is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National with me, Keri Phillips. Today we're piecing together the fractured history of the disputed Balkan province, Kosovo. Following the defeat of the Axis powers, Kosovo became an autonomous region of Serbia in what was to become the Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia under Josip Broz Tito.
Kosovo became a slight oddity within the Yugoslav state, if you like. Essentially, Yugoslavia post-1945, at the end of the Second World War, consisted of six republics: Slovenia, Croatia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Serbia, Macedonia and Montenegro. But there were also two autonomous regions. One was Vojvodina, which is in the north of Serbia, which had a significant Hungarian minority, and Kosovo in the south, which of course had an Albanian majority indeed. Now, the reason that Tito did this, he cut down the power of Serbia, essentially. The first Yugoslavia that existed from 1918 to essentially the outset or the beginning of the Second World War in that region in 1941, one of the reasons it collapsed is because Serbs dominated that first state, the first Yugoslavia. And in 1929, there was the imposition of a royal dictatorship, which was perceived as an imposition of a greater Serbia by the Croats, for example. So Tito recognised that perhaps one of the reasons why the first Yugoslavia failed is that perhaps the Serbs, although they were the most numerous, were also by far the most dominant. And in order to cut Serbia down to size, he created these two autonomous regions, and Kosovo was one of them. Now, in the period between 1953, let's say, and 1966, Tito's security chief in Yugoslavia was a man called Aleksandar Ranković. And Ranković imposed a fairly authoritarian rule in Kosovo, pretty unpleasant until 1966. Although it was an autonomous region, the Serb police were there, and Ranković made sure that any dissent from Kosovo Albanians, for example, was put down relatively brutally. So we can say that it was an autonomous region during this point, but it was, although it wasn't officially part of Serbia, Serbia remained in control, if you like, of Kosovo. Now, that changed in 1974. Tito introduced changes in the constitution in 1974, which actually bestowed Kosovo a separate constitution, separate from that of Serbia. And it was given the status of what was called a socialist autonomous province. And it had rights equal to those of the nations or republics of Yugoslavia. So it became a much, much more independent entity after the constitution of 1974. Now, of course, this happened in 1974, and what it meant, essentially, was that because this autonomous entity, Kosovo, could run its own affairs to some extent, of course, that helped consolidate Kosovan Albanian identity. They could run their own affairs, and of course, that fermented much of the kind of Albanian feeling there. After Tito's death in 1980, we start to see the first manifestations of Albanian nationalism, if you like, in Kosovo. There were riots in March 1981, and the central message of these mass protests was that the demand for Kosovo to become a republic. It was already an autonomous entity with quite a high level of autonomy, but the rioters were insisting upon Kosovo becoming a separate republic, which would have been the Seventh Republic of Yugoslavia. Now, that didn't happen, of course, and in March 1981, the troops, the Yugoslav army, were essentially sent in to quell the unrest. So although we don't see until the emergence of Slobodan Milosevic in 1986-87, the kind of re-emergence of the Kosovo question, there were problems much further before, just 1 year after Tito had died. In fact, less than a year. Tito died in May 1980. I mean, less than a year after he died, we see there are problems emerging in Kosovo already.
Throughout the 1980s, ethnic tensions grew in Kosovo, and the Serb cause was ultimately used as a political vehicle for the rise of Slobodan Milosevic.
The Serbian population began to argue that they were suffering, that they were having to leave their Serbian lands in Kosovo because they were being repressed by the Albanians, by the Albanian police, by the Albanian population. And there was all kinds of stories emerging during the mid-1980s about the treatment of Serbs by Albanians there. And there were several controversial books. There was a study conducted in Belgrade in 1985, which was talking about the status of Serbs and Montenegrins in Kosovo, or Kosovo Metohija, as they describe it, saying that Serbs were having to leave, they were being pressured to leave. Serbian birth rates were much lower, for example, than Albanian birth rates. I mean, it's true within Albanian communities, they have the highest birth rates in Europe. And there was a feeling that an exodus of some sort was going on down there in the 1980s. It was very, very emotive, and Serbs began to organise themselves down there. Now, at this time, they didn't enjoy any support from Belgrade because, of course, the line from the Communist Party in Belgrade at the time, the Yugoslav Communist Party, was what's called Bratstvo I Jedinstvo, which was brotherhood and unity. Everything could be sorted out between republics, between autonomous entities, but it all had to be done under the umbrella of Yugoslav communism. Any suggestion of national sentiment would normally land a person in prison. So there wasn't really a leader who would adopt the cause of Serbs in Kosovo. That changed in 1987 when Slobodan Milosevic, who was at that time the deputy of a chap called Ivan Stambolic, was sent to Kosovo by Ivan Stambolic to see what the situation was down there. There had been some problems between Serb ethnic communities and Albanian ethnic community down there. And when Milosevic went there, he essentially embraced the cause of the Kosovo Serbs. He said very famously, and this was seen on television, you will not be beaten again, to the Serbs. He made a promise, essentially, to adopt the Serb cause in Kosovo. And that was, in the 1980s, essentially the way to the top in Serbian politics, was to defend the interests of Serbia. There had been a paper, it was an unpublished document, very controversial, that emerged from what's called the Serbian Academy of Arts and Sciences in 1986, called the Memorandum. Now, in the memorandum, it essentially stated that Serbs were under threat in Kosovo and that the status of Serbs within Yugoslavia itself wasn't terribly good. That as the largest nation, they were in some sense the most repressed nation. And the memorandum caused an absolute storm at the time when it emerged. But no leader at the time was willing to adopt any of the ideas inherent in the memorandum. It wasn't until later that Milosevic realised the public support that could be garnered from the Kosovo issue, that he used the Kosovo issue and used it essentially to overthrow his political mentor, Ivan Stambolic. Milosevic had hung on his coattails all the way to the top, if you like, all the way to the top of the power structure, the Communist Party of Serbia. And then he essentially overthrew him in what was a kind of political assassination. So when Milosevic took over in 1988, one of the first things he did, of course, was change the policy towards Kosovo and Metohija.
For the last 5 days, the Yugoslav province of Kosovo has resembled the occupied territories of Palestine. Heavily armed Yugoslav riot police wearing tear gas masks and wielding batons have waged pitched battles with ethnic Albanians. These are protesting changes last week to their local constitution, which returns control over major decisions to their powerful neighbour Serbia. Today, the riots claimed their first victims, with the deaths of two policemen. By nightfall, some sort of peace had returned to Kosovo. A state of emergency is in force, as well as a curfew, and the smell of tear gas still lingers in the air. The atmosphere is tense, and no one is prepared to predict that in the morning the violence won't resume.
The history of Serb-Albanian relations in Kosovo was always one of whoever held the levers of power used them to discriminate against the other ethnic group. And basically what happened in 1989 after Milosevic came to power was that Serbian power was re-established in Kosovo. Massive purges took place among the Kosovo-Albanians from state administration. In turn, Kosovo-Albanians set up parallel structures and embarked on a policy of non-violent resistance to Serbian rule, but rejected the idea of being part of any Serbian state.
In 1990, the federation of six states that made up Yugoslavia began to collapse, involving Serbs, Croats and Bosniaks in a series of bloody ethnic and religious conflicts. In 1995, the Dayton Agreements brought an end to fighting in Croatia and Bosnia and Herzegovina, although the talks had not addressed the grievances of Kosovo Albanians.
After the Dayton Agreements, the Kosovo Albanian leadership was in a bit of a problematic situation in the sense that their demands and the issue of Kosovo as such wasn't even addressed at Dayton. So a great sense of frustration was prevalent. And also, this is in the period of between 96 and 98, you have the creation of alternative groupings in Kosovo, arguing that nonviolent resistance isn't leading anywhere, that in fact, it is now time to take up arms against Milosevic and against Serbia and to fight for independence, which is exactly what the Kosovo Liberation Army did. And they got arms through Albania, through various channels coming from outside, and they started basically a policy of armed resistance and of acts of terrorism, essentially, against Serbian security forces in the province. In response, you have pretty sort of indiscriminate retaliation by the Serbian security forces, escalating in the course of 1998 into a situation where you basically have a low-scale civil war going on.
But of course, full-scale war as such didn't break out until 1999. NATO threatened to intervene in Kosovo if the Serbs continued to what they defined, or what the international community defined, as the ethnic cleansing of Albanians in Kosovo. They threatened Serbia with intervention, with military intervention, which of course, as we know, in 1999 materialised with the NATO bombings in Kosovo and later on several Serbian cities.
We have had reports from an eyewitness at the military airport just outside the city of Belgrade, about 10 kilometers away from Belgrade, where they have seen fires and secondary explosions.
Ending this tragedy is a moral imperative. President Milosevic would read our hesitation as a license to kill.
Every effort will be made to spare the Serb people from any of the consequences.
But can you guarantee that there won't be casualties?
There are no guarantees in an operation like this.
The problem was that after the NATO forces arrived in Kosovo, the ground forces essentially entered Kosovo, the big problem was that those that had been oppressed, of course, became the oppressors. And the situation for Serbs became pretty desperate after the Serb troops left. What we have is a situation now where Kosovo is essentially partitioned. North of the Ibar River, mainly in the three municipalities in the north, you have the biggest town, North Mitrovica, which is predominantly Serbian. In the south of the Ibar River, you have predominantly Albanian areas, although there are some Serb enclaves in there. Now, those Serb enclaves within that area, south of the Ibar River, are perceive themselves to be, of course, in great danger because they're surrounded by Albanians. They often have to be given, for example, transportation by NATO troops in order to visit relatives or to actually go anywhere. So they're pretty isolated down there. But the north of Kosovo still remains predominantly Serbian, and there are very strong links between northern Kosovo and Serbia itself. There have been suggestions, many Serbian academics have suggested that Kosovo should be partitioned, that the north of Kosovo should essentially go to Serbia and the rest would essentially be independent, because I think even in Serbia now there is a realisation that Kosovo will become independent one way or the other, or receive very high levels of autonomy, quasi-independent. The issue with partition is that no one in the international community wants partition. They don't want to change borders in Kosovo or anywhere else. There is also an issue with Kosovan independence. If it happens, it creates a slightly difficult pretext globally, not just for this region, but Kosovo wasn't one of the six republics of the former Yugoslavia. Now, in 1991, a group of expert judges known as the Badinter Commission ruled that all of the republics of Yugoslavia could become independent, the six republics of Yugoslavia, but the autonomous entities couldn't. Now, if you recognise Kosovo as an independent state, the problem is, well, that opens up other questions. It opens up questions of Abkhazia, for example, or breakaway movements in Georgia and in South Ossetia. So it actually represents a much bigger problem. It may open up a Pandora's box. And of course, I think the international community are very aware that that's the case, although they would argue that Kosovo is a distinct problem itself.
A recent referendum in Serbia approved a new constitution, reasserting Serbia's claim to Kosovo, while the Albanians living there are in a restless mood, soured by 7 years of political limbo. Whatever the UN proposal, now expected early next year, neither side is likely to be satisfied. Rear Vision's technical producer is John Jacobs. I'm Keri Phillips. Bye for now.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.